From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week in Trump began on an atypically upbeat note. On Tuesday night, the president gave his first joint address to Congress.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, the First Lady of the United States.
Many in the pundit class gave the president high marks for his use of the palliative presidential platitude.
The speech has gone a long way towards unifying a divided country.
I feel like tonight, Donald Trump became the president of the United States.
I thought last night was unifying. I thought it was presidential.
It's as if the president had one of those gizmos from Men in Black, making them forget everything unpresidential and divisive they've experienced for the past 18 months. Still, the president stood before the Congress, and he did not embarrass it. And that was deeply reassuring for commentators who find comfort in the familiar so they can say something familiar. Pundits have their priorities, and no one knows that better than Trump, as Trevor Noah pointed out on The Daily Show.
You don't have to be a genius to figure out that Donald Trump is playing you. You look at his record. You can study his previous actions. Or you know what else you could do? You could just listen to him when he tells you that he's gonna fake it.
I can act as presidential as anybody that's ever been president.
Presidential's easy. You know what a presidential is? I walk on. Here's what I... Ladies and gentlemen of Waterbury, it is a great honor to be with you this morning.
Yeah. Fake like you're presidential, and people will believe you're presidential. This was the plan all along.
But the president had barely a news cycle to bask in that presidential glow. On Wednesday night, he was menaced again with that perpetually falling piano, the Russian connection. This time it landed on Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who in January was asked by Senator Al Franken if he would investigate alleged ties between the Trump campaign and Russia.
I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I didn't have communications with the Russians, and I'm unable to comment on it.
On Wednesday, a rather different story emerged.
The Washington Post now reporting tonight that Attorney General Jeff Sessions, when he was still a senator and an advisor to the Trump campaign, had meetings with Russia's ambassador to the U.S., but did not disclose them during his confirmation hearings.
Sessions settled for just making himself scarce.
I have now decided to recuse myself from any existing or future investigations of any matter relating in any way to the campaigns for President of the United States.
The news about Sessions' Russian rendezvous coincided with another revelation.
New reporting tonight about what the Obama administration learned in its final days about Russian interference in the presidential election.
The report says the officials wanted to leave a clear trail of intelligence before the Trump administration took over.
As the New York Times reported, Obama administration officials purposefully documented and spread information across the government about Russian interference in the election. They did this to alert future investigators and to ensure that the information would not crumble to dust in a presidential broom closet. National security and intelligence reporter Matthew Rosenberg co-wrote the Times story. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's start with the what. Explain what information Obama administration officials scrambled to preserve.
The actual details of that information are still really murky. You know, this stuff is incredibly classified. Even telling us that it exists risks going to jail. We do know a few things. We know that there were contacts between Trump associates and Russian officials throughout the campaign. Some officials say they're intelligence people, but that's a pretty murky designation in Russia where even a lot of top business people, if they're close to Putin, they're kind of in the intelligence world.
They have many jobs to do.
Exactly. And we also know that there were a lot of conversations intercepted between officials in the Kremlin and other places in which the Russians themselves were debating how far to go with this.
You also had some information from American allies, the British and the Dutch, who described meetings in European cities.
Some European allies, we believe there were a number of them, who were hearing about meetings through their own sources and tipping off the Americans saying, hey, what's this going on here? We don't really understand this.
Now, you described a number of strategies that Obama White House officials used to create this paper trail of intelligence. For instance, simply sending packages to members of Congress?
I think we want to be clear that this was beyond the White House. These are senior officials in the intelligence community, in the national security world, some in the White House. And one of the things they did, we know of at least one instance, we believe there were others, a Senate committee requested information on Russian election meddling worldwide. And a few days before the end of the administration, they got delivered a cache of folders, all stamped secret.
We should mention that secret is really not that high of a classification.
It's not. And that's, I think, where you get into what they were really trying to do. Step back and look at the context here. Through the summer into the fall, there's the hacking, there's the release of the emails, there's questions about voter rolls being probed by hackers, but there's no real sense of exactly how big a campaign this is going on. And it's only into November and December that people in the administration say they begin to put all the pieces together and see the scope and depth and breadth of what they believe the Russians had done. They then engage in this very kind of almost last minute rush to kind of get information out there in ways that's not just left there kind of on the cutting room floor and hard to find and hard to access. And so one of the ways you do that is you take the raw intelligence, the actual intercepts, human intelligence reports, and you process that into what they call a finished report. And you try and get as low as level of classification on that finished report as possible, and then move that around the intelligence community, as wide an audience for it as you can.
You also reported that Obama officials and I guess officials in other agencies asked questions of the intelligence agencies in order to get certain answers on the record.
Yeah, and that was part of that leaving a trail for investigators.
Mm-hmm.
You get a briefing every day. You ask your briefer a specific question to which you know the answer, but you also know the briefer's got to write that down. And that becomes part of an archive, and that any investigator in the House or the Senate is going to know to look for those archives, and it will lead them to information you want them to find.
And your sources within the administration made clear that the reason why they did this was to ensure that it would be very difficult for the new administration to come in and just completely bury it all.
Oh, absolutely. Some of these sources were very upfront about this. We want this out there because we want people to know it's there and they should go look for it.
You write about how the intelligence collecting and documenting continued up until the final days of the Obama administration. And you explained that it wasn't until they had thoroughly put the pieces together that the Russian government was trying to directly influence the election in favor of Trump.
Yeah.
And they didn't figure that out until that late.
Yeah, we were pretty shocked by that. I think, you know, in the public's mind, there's a sense that there's a big thing going on. But when you think about it, you know, what exactly our government thought it was, at least, wasn't really clear until into December and January. You have the cyber attacks on the DNC, which took place a long time ago. Then you have another element of the campaign, which is the pushing of the stolen material out, WikiLeaks, Guccifer. And the third element was the probing and hacking into state electoral systems and the stealing of voter rolls there. That happened in September, and that was really the first thing that truly alarmed the White House. But at the time, they thought it was because the Russians were trying to find ways to muck around and raise questions about what would go on Election Day, that they were going to try and disrupt the actual voting or cast doubt on that voting. That's obviously not what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing throughout is they're listening to Russians who are equally as convinced as most Americans were that Hillary Clinton was probably going to win. The Russians weren't thinking that they were winning this for Trump. They were as surprised as everyone else.
But they didn't like Hillary.
The Russians really disliked Clinton. And so this was a lot more about weakening the U.S., disrupting democracy, and overcoming Clinton than it was about Trump.
The meetings that the appointed Trump team had denied having with the Russians could have come out more directly. Why not just a more straightforward statement about these things from people who knew? Is it because the material is classified?
Exactly. As long as the material remains classified and you have a clearance, means you can see it, you can't talk about it. But we talked to a lot of people, and these are both political appointees and career officials, not just a bunch of Obama partisans, who seemed very unsatisfied with the level of classification and the inability or unwillingness to declassify more information before they left office.
Mm-hmm.
I think they knew, and that's one of the big problems here, is that what the public's seen so far is not particularly satisfying. We've seen a lot of very strong language. We've seen some details, most of which have leaked out, but we don't actually know what this evidence is. So we've got these competing claims.
Right. The Trump team has denied that the campaign had any contact with the Russians. They blame the intelligence agencies for cooking this up. Your story reports that the Obama administration was just concerned that this whole thing was going to be buried, so it left clues. And then there's the conspiracy theory that we saw on Thursday in the Daily Caller. The headline read, "Confirmed, Obama administration sabotaged Trump's transition to the White House."
I love when the Daily Caller uses us to confirm what they want confirmed. Look, I find conspiracies pretty hard to believe. Usually it's just incompetence. But in this case, it's a bunch of officials, some of them probably working together, who were genuinely freaked out. I mean, I spoke to these people. I've known them a while, some of them. They were really freaked out by what they were seeing, and they wanted to make sure that investigations could progress. But the Trump campaign isn't entirely wrong either. You know, there is some sour grapes here.
Everyone has their motive. I mean, Deep Throat was annoyed that Nixon didn't promote him inside of the FBI. But the motives don't matter, right? It's the value of the information.
Exactly. Look, sources are really imperfect people. I've had great sources who were right and left-wing nuts, who had detestable views of the world, but they provided incredibly valuable information. No matter how you feel about the people we're talking to, and I wish I could tell you more about them, if what they're saying is true, and there are a lot of them saying the same thing, independent of each other, what they're providing is really stunning and really interesting.
But it's based on secret information that comes from almost entirely anonymous sources. And as you wrote, it makes an independent public assessment of competing Trump and Obama administration claims impossible.
You know, it is the great frustration of reporting in Washington, especially on national security matters, is that you're dealing with stuff that is sensitive and that, again, your sources risk their freedom to talk to you about it. We're careful explaining that we have a lot of sources on this. We're careful in explaining why the sources are talking to us. We're trying to kind of show as much as we can to give some confidence that we're not just kind of making this up or talking to people who have no credibility to speak on these matters.
Well, the White House spokesman, Sean Spicer, kind of echoed the Daily Caller when he said, "The only new piece of information that has come to light is that political appointees in the Obama administration have sought to create a false narrative to make an excuse for their own defeat in the election. There continues to be no there there." Are you convinced that there's enough there there?
I don't know what to think. People, some still in the government, seem very convinced there's something there. And if I were the Trump administration and there was no there there, I'd probably want a pretty thorough investigation to end this all.
The fact is that no intelligence official seems to be claiming on or off the record that they have actual evidence of active collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, at least not yet.
No. What they do tell us, though, is that, you know, stuff was pouring in until the day they left office and that it still is coming in, apparently. What they are absolutely thoroughly convinced of is of this Russian campaign. There's no doubt about it at this point in their estimation. The Trump stuff's murkier because there were a lot of meetings, but you don't know exactly what went on in all of them.
So do you think that maybe we're making too much of this?
No, because, you know, in the end, this is why you don't have meetings like this and why you don't deny things even when they're apparent to everyone is because appearances matter. This doesn't look good. And I think the administration does owe American people straightforward answers about what exactly is going on here. And they say they're being straightforward, but, you know, it comes out in January that their former national security advisor, Mike Flynn, had been talking to the Russian ambassador the day that the Obama administration imposed sanctions, December 29th. And the initial White House response today, it was one phone call, text message, and it was just about logistics for a call with Putin. Comes out a few weeks later that it was a lot of phone calls. It was about the sanctions and telling the Russians, don't worry, we'll be in power soon. And Flynn had misled the vice president. And that the White House had known this for 2 weeks. They had known what they had told the public was untrue.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've got Jeff Sessions, who told Congress he never met with any Russians during the campaign. Turns out he had met the ambassador twice. Now he says, well, we weren't meeting about campaign things. You're getting this pattern here of they say nothing happened, then you find out something did. They say, well, it's no big deal. Then you find out it was. And they say, well, the leaks are the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think until that kind of pattern ends or there are some answers about what exactly is going on here, these questions are going to persist, and they should persist. They absolutely should persist.
Okay, so now as we talk on Thursday, obviously, Flynn is long gone. Yes. Sessions has recused himself from any investigation into the Russian hacking or connections with the Trump administration. You have also reported that Jared Kushner, advisor to Trump, and his son-in-law was with Flynn, at least during one of those meetings. So we have a couple of shoes that have dropped. Do you anticipate any more in the near future?
I suspect we'll be finding out a lot more, unless this is some giant conspiracy and we're all being played for the fool, which I don't believe to be the case, and I really hope it isn't. I can say this much, that I've learned to stop predicting what's going on over there. Mm-hmm. Just have no idea. You know, me and a colleague were looking into some other totally unrelated story, but involved a very senior job for somebody. There's a lot of confusion about it. Eventually, the person who's the subject of our reporting, who was up for this very senior job, called us up to say, hey, you guys know what's on this job? Because I'm getting a lot of mixed signals from the White House. We're just like, I think, yeah, that's not the way this is supposed to work, sir. You know, I mean.
Matthew, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Matthew Rosenberg covers intelligence and national security for The New York Times.
Coming up, media manipulations at home and abroad, as usual.
This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. After the American election, Russian media were dominated by heavy and happy coverage of Trump. Literally. In January, state media outlets said Trump's name about 55,000 more times than Putin's, according to reports by the Russian news agency Interfax. Fawning headlines were the norm, with news anchors rushing to defend Donald Trump from, quote, immoral reporters clawing at him on the smallest pretense. But not anymore. Bloomberg recently reported that the Kremlin ordered state media to tone down their Trump coverage. Last week, an article in the Russian newspaper Moskovsky Komsomolets wrote that, quote, everything's a muddle in the White House. Alexei Kovalev is news editor at the English-language weekly newspaper The Moscow Times. Alexei, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, Bob.
Back in the bad old days of Soviet communism, there was this exercise called Kremlinology, where media and U.S. intelligence would have to deduce and divine what was going on behind the scenes based on clues like who was standing next to whom at a parade. I wonder if watching Russian media, we can still perform the same kind of Kremlinology and figure out what Putin is really thinking.
I think that would be a bit of a mistake, because what you see on Russian television is not what Putin thinks or members of his administration or his staff. It's what they want people to think. It's important to note here that the state media in Russia, and not just the formerly state media, which is about 70% of all media in Russia, they are very literally micromanaged from Putin's administration. It's the deputy chief of staff of Putin. And he just picks up the phone and calls the editors-in-chief of the federal TV channels and major newspapers and basically tells them what to write and, more importantly, what not to cover. Putin's spokesman has denied that this has taken place, but it's quite obvious to see how carefully controlled and choreographed the coverage on the Russian state media is.
During the course of the election and the first few weeks of the Trump administration, it's been all Trump all the time, huh?
Новый конфликт между прессой и Дональдом Трампом разгорается в США.
Похоже, что Трамп намерен сделать крутой поворот.
Корни звезда Голливуда Арнольд Шварценеггер предложил президенту США Дональду Трампу поменяться работой.
Дональд Трамп разворошил политический муравейник.
All Trump all the time and extremely positive to the point of being quite creepy. In the run-up to the election, the Russian media is not so much praising Trump, but blasting Obama and Hillary Clinton, whom Putin very much personally hates. After the elections, they were casting Trump as this anti-establishment figure. He's unbound, he's unfettered, and he's this champion who is going to be our new best friend. Because everybody's just really tired of this anti-American sentiment. Russian-American relations were at the lowest point since the Cold War.
The 24/7 Trump coverage on Russian TV has waned. When did things change and why?
It changed after Trump's tweet about Russia taking Crimea.
President Trump is tweeting today in response to the latest Russian controversy. He said, quote, Crimea was taken by Russia during the Obama administration. Was Obama too soft on Russia?
And that went so much against everything Russian state propaganda had been praising Trump for. There he is, him and his appointees and his UN envoy making all these belligerent statements.
Crimea is a part of Ukraine. Our Crimea-related sanctions will remain in place until Russia returns control over the peninsula to Ukraine.
And they were trying so hard to rationalize this. Like, he's beset on all sides by these Russophobic elements in the Congress, and they're undermining him. Or maybe it's Obama sabotaging him, because they are trying incredibly hard to rationalize the statements by Rex Tillerson, among others.
Russia must know that we will be accountable to our commitments and those of our allies, and that Russia must be held to account for its actions.
And they were trying to frame this as, okay, he's only saying those things to get approved by the Congress, like blah, 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 but yeah, we're still friends. He's still on our side. But at some point, it just became untenable, and they did flip a switch, and it's been so much more toned down the coverage of Trump on the state television.
Trump mania in English or Russian makes good TV. What has filled the vacuum of all Trump all the time?
Well, there's always a variety of subjects, like finding new internal enemies, slandering the old ones, like the political opposition in Russia, or in a quite unexpected twist, there's an ongoing flame war between the Russian state propaganda, and bear with me here, it's very convoluted. So there's a pro-Putin, ultra-patriotic group that is now campaigning against a Trump mania on Russian TV.
This is the far-right party that believes that, in effect, for the last 20 years, Russia, Putin's Russia, has been occupied by Western interests, particularly the United States.
Yes, precisely. Since 1991, Russia has been under occupation by the United States, and all the legislators and all the judges and all the courts and all the media are in the American cabal. The only person in Russia who is free from the American occupation is Putin himself and these campaigners. So they are pitting themselves against these immense propaganda machine, and it's quite entertaining to watch.
I'm not sure if you realize this. You've been on our show before. We quoted a piece you wrote for Medium titled, A Message to My Doomed Colleagues in the American Media. It was about how Trump is as impossible to pin down as Putin was. It's been chaotic, but I wonder how you think the U.S. press is doing so far.
I'm seeing a lot of soul-searching in the American media, which isn't such a bad thing, and the familiar tropes are being turned upside down. It's really fun to watch you guys discover the same frustrations that we've faced for the past two decades. But it's a much healthier media environment than Russia. You have the First Amendment. And unless Donald Trump somehow manages to completely dismantle the foundations of American democracy, I don't think you're ever going to end up in the same situation as we are now. Like, you don't really have the state-controlled media. And I was listening to you on the media last week where you discussed the relationship between Donald Trump and Fox News, where Donald Trump repeats everything Fox News says. Well, in Russia, it's inverted. Everything that Putin says is religiously repeated by the entire state media apparatus, absolutely uncritically. He literally holds the button. He can press the button and it all goes blank. So after a bit of soul searching, you know, adapting to this new reality, I think the American media will do just fine.
Alexei, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Alexei Kovalev is a news editor for the Moscow Times and founder and editor of the website The Noodle Remover. Alexei, the noodle remover?
It's a fact-checking and media critique website, and my favorite Russian expression, to hang noodles on someone's ears, means to lie, to deceive someone. So I'm removing those noodles, figuratively.
Right now, there's a lot of noodle removal underway in Russia's neighbor, Ukraine. In 2014, to counter the spirit of popular revolution against Russian control, Ukrainian media was rife with misinformation and propaganda pouring in from Russia. Fake news filled the vacuum of reliable information about what was happening on the ground. One group of volunteers at the Kiev Mohyla Academy's School of Journalism got together and started Stop Fake, a media outlet that would tackle the fake news head on. What started as a blog with a few posts debunking Russian propaganda has in the past 3 years become a reputable news source for Ukrainians, with a nightly TV show broadcast on 30 local channels, a weekly radio show, and a large social media following. Yevgen Fedchenko is one of the co-founders and current editor-in-chief of Stop Fake and the director of the School of Journalism at the Kiev Mohyla Academy. Yevgen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
What was your first story?
Russian television was repeating all the time the stories that thousands of Ukrainian refugees fled in from Ukraine to Russia. And we called to Russian Migration Service and asked how many Ukrainians asked for refugee status over there, because still there was no war at that point. And so the question is why Ukraine would have refugees. So we started to check, and it appeared that absolutely very few people asked for asylum in Russia, for refugee status. So it was absolutely fake. And the intention of propaganda was actually to create the wave of refugees, because if people would be watching television and see that everybody is trying to flee Ukraine, so they would just follow. But there was an interesting follow-up to this story. Those people whom we interview said that we don't have any refugees from Ukraine, but we've been told from Moscow to prepare to the avalanche of Ukrainian refugees. So it was a very clear warning that something is up and probably military actions would be the next stage of the escalation of the conflict.
Okay, so let's start with Russian propaganda. What were some of the characteristic themes and topics that you saw?
The most widespread topics were the accusations that in Ukraine there is a coup d'etat, not a popular uprising, that a fascist junta came to power, that Ukraine actually is collapsing, and many other frames.
And one that I see throughout history, crucifying Russian-speaking children in Ukraine.
That was the most interesting case for us. It was aired on primetime television in Russia. And when journalists who produced this story were confronted and people demanded explanations, they said it's not us journalists who should find facts supporting this story, but that's all you in the audience should prove that this story never happened.
Do you have any actual proof that the fake news you've been seeing is coming directly from the Russian government?
At the very beginning, when we just were starting our website, we really might have doubts about that. But during 3 years, we already collected more than 1,000 stories. And we see how the same frames are repeated all the time, how the same media organizations or so-called media organizations are engaged in manufacturing and spreading those fakes, and how this propaganda is overlapping with the talking points from Russian government.
Mm-hmm. Stop Fake has been around for about 3 years, and you started the TV show only about a week into launching the project. How has it grown since then?
The idea behind TV show was Russian propaganda is mostly using Russian television to spread propaganda, so it would be very logical to answer symmetrically in a form of TV show, which not only was debunking fake stories, but explaining to ordinary people in the audience how fakes are produced, how they can identify them, and what kind of an impact fake news can have on their life.
So that they themselves would be able to distill the truth from this sea of BS.
Absolutely. Our most read article ever is How to Spot a Fake. Millions and millions of people read that, and we are empowering them to understand what they can use to do that. For example, on a website, we have a section called Tools, where we explain to ordinary people how they can become debunkers themselves, how they can use different technologically available tools or just some journalistic instruments to check their information.
You also show them how to verify YouTube videos, and you even have a guide on how to do research on Russian public officials using the Russian internet. What are your indicators that it's actually having an impact? Is there any way to tell if they've actually become more media literate?
We have some indicators which are quite promising. For example, we've seen from the polls that the audience of Russian television in Ukraine dropped to the historically low level of 8% compared to 100% a couple of years ago. And among those 8%, only 3% are trusting what they're watching. People are much surer now what they are dealing with when they are watching Russian television.
It's been widely reported that Russian propaganda has been flooding Europe in an effort to demean democracy and destabilize those societies, and that it's actually having an effect. You've been partnering with NGOs in other European countries to look at Russian propaganda?
We partner together because in every country, our local partners are monitoring the local situation and they know local languages, local media landscape, so they can look into what instruments they use, what patterns are behind. And then when we get together all that information, we can map and put it into the comparative perspective to see what is happening in different countries. And we find a lot of similarities. The Ukrainian toolbox is very widely used across the whole Europe.
Yevgen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yevgen Fedchenko is one of the co-founders and current editor-in-chief of Stop Fake and the director of the School of Journalism at Kiev Mohyla Academy. You can find a link to his fake news detection tools at onthemedia.org. Coming up, what the founders thought about corruption.
This is On the Media.
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
Been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. So the big story this week concerns, yet again, the Trump administration's undisclosed entanglements with Russia. It's worth remembering that the Rosetta Stone for all of the Russian mysteries may reside in the president's tax returns, which, of course, Trump has refused to release. Legal scholar Jed Sugarman believes that the Constitution's Emoluments Clause could shake those tax returns loose and that state attorneys general have the standing to sue to get them. Sugarman teaches law at Fordham University School of Law. Jed, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You want state attorneys general where the Trump Organization does business, particularly New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, to file suit against the company under the Emoluments Clause. But that clause is in the U.S. Constitution. Is it really a matter for individual states?
State attorneys general, not only in New York, but throughout the country, have the legal power and the legal duty to make sure corporations are following the rule of law, not just state law, but federal law and constitutional law when it comes to anti-corruption.
And by so doing, actually get access to the tax returns by subpoena or by the discovery process.
Discovery should be able to get the financial records, the debt records, and the tax returns to enable the judicial system to look at the full picture. So the first step is important in terms of just our basic importance for the public interest of transparency in government.
But you're also interested in the case itself, not just the taxes.
The second step is looking at remedies here, because it's important for us to see how foreign countries are using payments and debts as part of manipulation of the financial picture. Then that also connects to what's going on behind the scenes with this very bizarre behavior of the Trump campaign to now the Trump administration of being so solicitous and having so much flexibility to the Putin regime.
So whether or not it proves a high crime or misdemeanor that the Congress is obliged to deal with, the tax return would be made public.
Exactly.
It's a very ingenious notion. Have you heard from the New York Attorney General's office?
So other journalists have confirmed publicly that the New York Attorney General's office is looking at this proceeding. And several news outlets have looked at this, and I think they are optimistic. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman was terrific in taking the lead against the Trump Corporation in a fairly similar kind of question about fraud. It wasn't just the victims of the fraud with Trump University. It was also Eric Schneiderman who pioneered a public suit. And so if he was willing to take on Trump University, he's certainly willing to take on the Trump Corporation.
When you walk through the halls at school, do people look at you and go, ooh, look at you?
I've never had an experience like this. Usually, like, people sort of tolerate my legal history, 19th century archival navel gazing. But now people walk up and they say, what's happening now? Right? Like, there's nothing like a legal historian suddenly stumbling into finding a way that history can be made relevant.
Jed, thanks very much.
Terrific, Bob.
Law professor Jed Sugarman is author of Sugar Blog.
Last week, a Chinese-American executive named Angela Chen, who runs a company that explicitly helps cultivate U.S.-Chinese business relationships, bought a nearly $16 million penthouse in a Trump high-rise in Manhattan. Trump owns this high-rise, so this Chinese-American dealmaker and professional courtier effectively paid Trump $16 million. Before taking office, the president resigned from the Trump Organization and left his sons to run the company, but he still profits from his empire. The question of whether his vast business entanglements violate corruption rules clearly isn't settled. But it shows how far we've come from the original intent of the founders. Because for them, says Zephyr Teachout, author of Corruption in America, even a snuffbox could be a source of suspicion. Zephyr, welcome to OTM.
It's wonderful to be on.
I think Ben Franklin got ensnared by a snuffbox, didn't he?
Yeah. Franklin had spent some time in France. He was well-loved by the French court. In fact, a lot of people were worried about his loyalties. And then when he was leaving his diplomatic tour, he got this really glamorous, diamond-encrusted snuffbox. And a portrait of the French king. And this caused a fair amount of concern, and in fact was part of the reason that we have in our Constitution the provision called the Emoluments Clause, which prohibits taking gifts as well as offices and titles of nobility from foreign governments.
What's an emolument?
Basically, it's situations in which you're getting paid by foreign governments. I think the easiest way to think about it is something of value. This is one of those rare constitutional clauses that tells you how to read it. It includes this phrase, of any kind whatever. And it's really clear from reading contemporary understandings of the word emoluments that it covered a broad range of situations, including business enterprises.
Why were the founders so concerned about corruption? You call it their constant obsession.
These are not naive writers of our Constitution. They've experienced what they perceive as the intense corruption of Britain, and they're all steeped in the story that Rome was torn apart from the inside by corruption. It's saying we are not going to engage in this culture of having financial relationships between diplomats and governments. It's thumbing its nose at European practice, even though they cared so, so deeply about developing their own trading relations. The anti-corruption principle was so important to Americans that they were willing to sacrifice some comfort and ease in those relationships to have this anti-corruption principle.
So going back to the snuff boxes.
Yes.
What did they decide? How do they thread that needle of forbidding gifts while existing in a world where this was the general custom?
The practice that developed was to allow Congress to basically bless gifts that came in. Congress would typically say, that's okay, you can keep that snuff box. Or when John Jay got a horse from the government of Spain, Congress gave Jay permission to keep the horse. This congressional check plays this really important role because it brings the relationship into the daylight. The American public, through Congress, gets to understand what was the nature of the gift. And also then Congress provides this important check if there's anything suspicious, if there's any sense that this might actually lead to either an explicit bribe or to influence that would really undermine the integrity of our decision making.
In your book, you emphasize, and this is really important, that the founders forbid presents, not bribes. No exchange or agreement is required to bring it within the ban.
It's really clear that the framers did not think that corruption was just quid pro quo or explicit exchanges. They really understood how humans can be tempted to betray their loyalties without even really being aware of it. So you need rules that, you know, in law we call these bright line rules or prophylactic rules. Rules that basically say, you just can't do this category of behavior because there's a significant likelihood that if you're in this category of behavior, something wrong is going to happen. So the category is taking gifts or payments. We're not going to necessarily know which ones are influencing, nor are we going to easily discover which ones there might be an agreement around. But we need to ban the category so that we don't risk corruption.
But the founders' anti-corruption vision quickly ran into problems, not in Europe, but on our own shores. I'm thinking of a word that if we were alive 200 years ago, you say we would all have an opinion on. Yazoo.
Yazoo, yes. The Yazoo scandal really occupied the press and the public. Everybody had a position on Yazoo. So Yazoo refers to the lands in western Georgia. And the Georgia legislature gives away millions of acres for pennies on an acre to land speculators.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out, basically, all of the lawmakers who'd voted for this land giveaway were getting paid by the land speculators.
Now, the public threw out every lawmaker who'd voted for the deal, right?
Yes, and that wasn't enough. They actually had a bonfire in the Capitol to burn the bill. And the new lawmakers immediately passed a law saying that law was not a law because it was passed through bribery.
You can burn the bill and you can pass a law, but you don't get rid of the larger issue, at least not in this case.
That's right. The larger issue here is whether a law stops being a law because it was passed in part because of corruption. And this case goes on for years, finally makes it to the Supreme Court. One of my favorite facts about this case is it's the only case I know of where one of the litigators needed time to sober up halfway through oral argument. And basically, the question was, who really owned the land at this point? Was it still held by the people of Georgia? Or was it held by the people who had bought their land ownership from the speculators?
So the speculators that had bribed the Georgian legislators sold the land to people who thought they had a legitimate contract. And basically, the court said the contract superseded the anti-corruption concerns raised by Georgia.
Yeah, that's right. Justice Marshall, who, by the way, had been a land speculator himself, said, it's so sad that corruption has crept into our young republic, but it's sort of beyond the scope of this court to pass judgment on what was a fundamentally corrupt contract and what was not. And the reason I find this episode really interesting is in part because it shows the awkward relationship between law and corruption. But really until the 1970s, court after court after court understood that protecting against corruption inside our country was one of the jobs of our country and was one of the greatest threats to our country. And then you see that kind of drop away really in the 1970s.
So take us there. What happened?
So in 1976, the Supreme Court decided a really important case, Buckley versus Vallejo, and struck down some campaign finance laws and set up a two-step process that we've really been living inside ever since. The first step is to ask, when there is a campaign finance rule, does that campaign finance rule infringe on freedom of speech? And the second step is to say, if it does it, however, serve an anti-corruption interest? Suddenly, it really matters what corruption means. Because if corruption just means explicit quid pro quo, then a lot of what we think of as anti-corruption laws are going to get struck down.
So back in the days of the founders, they recognized that something could be corrupt even if it wasn't illegal. Now you have to find an explicit exchange of something for something, a quid pro quo, and only a complete boob would get caught doing that. So much of this exchange is either behind closed doors or through intermediaries or is just assumed. So the kind of ambiguity in human nature, the indirect influence that the founder saw as corruption is now, strictly speaking, only if you have sold your office or your vote.
No, that's right. And the loss is enormous. It's certainly a loss of a central part of our heritage as a country. We were founded on an anti-corruption passion, but it was also incredible wisdom. It was an understanding that corruption is this very serious threat to self-government. And we've certainly felt the effects. We felt the effects in the super PACs that have arisen since Citizens United. And we as citizens are left with fewer and fewer tools to fight corruption.
Which brings us to now. You're currently working on behalf of a group called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, trying to revive those long-lost anti-corruption traditions by suing Donald Trump for violating the Emoluments Clause. What makes you believe that that could possibly work, especially without his tax returns, and especially without standing?
There's a lot of really hard, complicated, interesting corruption law questions. Donald Trump violating the Emoluments Clause is not one of them. It is really straightforward that he is violating the Constitution and began violating it on the day he took office.
Why?
Well, there's four different ways in which he's basically getting things of value from foreign governments. The first is through the Trump Tower in New York City. The Chinese government, through the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, is one of the largest tenants in Trump Tower. So we basically have the Chinese government putting payments into Donald Trump's pockets. The second flow of emoluments, dignitaries from foreign governments staying in Trump hotels. Mm-hmm. The third is through The Apprentice and The New Celebrity Apprentice. In two countries at least, the payments for royalties around The Apprentice come from government-owned entities. And then the fourth area is all the Trump Organization developments around the world require government action, whether in Turkey or India or China. And the governments are in a position to make our president richer or poorer. I think the important thing to understand is that the Emoluments Clause is a bright line rule. It's like a speed limit. If the speed limit is 55 and someone's going 68, they don't get to turn to the cop and say, well, the roads were dry and nobody else was around. Therefore, it isn't a violation. This is a safety rule, right? If a federal officer is taking payments from foreign governments, the federal officer doesn't get to turn around and say, oh, well, in this particular instance, I wasn't getting influenced. It doesn't matter. You violated the rule.
Well, let me ask you this. The clause says that Congress has to approve, right?
That's right.
So if Trump wanted this to go away, couldn't he just get the Congress, which is pretty supine these days, to just approve?
Yeah, it's quite striking that he hasn't gone to Congress to ask for their approval. To do that, he would have to reveal the full extent of the nature of the payments. Congress could either accept and say, you can keep those, or reject and say, you can't keep those. It's certainly a direction that Trump could be undertaking, but instead he's just violating the Constitution every day.
Zephyr, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Zephyr Teachout is a law professor at Fordham University and author of the book, Corruption in America.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Michael Lowinger, Sara Kari, Leah Feder, and Kate Bakhtiarova. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Terrence Bernardo.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.